Is Florida forgetting the Forgotten Coast?
Why has the recovery in the panhandle been so slow after Hurricane Michael?
And the new governor wants new school standards as he takes aim at Common Core curriculum.
This is the Florida Roundup from WLRN Public Media in Miami and WJCT Public Media in Jacksonville. I'm Tom Hudson.
And I'm Melissa Ross. Well, Hurricane Michael devastated parts of the panhandle nearly 4 months ago. Recovery and money to help with cleanup and rebuilding has been really slow in coming. Could the state find money to help? Also this week, Governor DeSantis wants to erase what's left of Common Core from public schools. What does that mean for students, teachers, and parents?
You can join the conversation statewide, 305-995-1800, or on social media at Florida Roundup on Twitter. It's all ahead on the Florida Roundup, next after the news. Welcome to the Florida Roundup this week. Thanks for listening. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. And we begin the hour today with a look at the predicament of the state's so-called Forgotten Coast. Hurricane Michael brought 150-mile-an-hour winds and devastating storm surge to parts of the panhandle almost 4 months ago. But money, help, and donations have been very slow in coming. Insured losses in the region have topped $5 billion. And Tom, millions more in damage just aren't covered by insurance.
Yeah, the price tag to clean up and to rebuild continues climbing. The state, Melissa, is looking perhaps at using some money from the BP oil spill settlement to help in the recovery. Reporter Sean Mulcahy from WFSU recently visited Mariana, which was right in the path of Michael's eye.
Inside the city, trees still lay on houses. Roofs have given way to blue tarps. Branches, tree trunks, and wreckage line the streets. I meet Betty Roberts in a Walmart parking lot. She says recovery has been
slow. It's frustrating because you have to wait for somebody to have time to come do the repairs. So I haven't had anything done at my house yet. I'm still waiting on the man to come put the vinyl back on.
Robert says she's lucky. Damage to her property wasn't too bad. A tree fell on her patio, and the 150-mile-per-hour winds ripped the vinyl siding off her house. Others weren't as fortunate.
My trailer was blown off the blocks. The roof was blown off of it. The inside was severe damage with water. Trees blew down on my fences.
Lawrence Adkins has lived in Mariana his whole life. There aren't enough contractors here to keep up with the amount of work that needs to be done, he says.
My mom's house, she got some damage, and I've been trying to find a contractor for her. Closest thing I can find is like March or April before they even come look at it.
For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sean Mulcahy.
Wow, so has the Forgotten Coast of Florida, as it's known, truly been forgotten? We're talking about debris still littering roadways, tarps still on roofs, many people still living in tents. Donations have been so slow to come in, and lawmakers are working on an aid package for this region. We begin the hour here on the Florida Roundup with a closer look at the continued dire situation in the panhandle. Do you have family or friends affected by Michael? Maybe you even had to relocate out of the panhandle after the storm. Are you frustrated that it seems the area is not getting the help that it needs? Give us a call right now. Anywhere in the state at 305-995-1800 or tweet the show at Florida Roundup. As we welcome Emily Mahoney, she's a reporter with the Tampa Bay Times and Miami Herald. She joins us from WFSU in Tallahassee. Also with us, Jessica Foster, an anchor and reporter with WJHG News in Panama City. Jessica, let's begin with you. Hearing those folks in Mariana talk about their predicament is not news to you. You've been covering this for months. And so let me begin by asking you about the donations coming into the panhandle with billions in damages. The money coming in to mitigate the situation is nowhere where it needs to be. How much more money is needed as opposed to what's coming in?
You know, it really is nowhere where it needs to be. And especially when you look at other natural disasters and how much has come in. You know, we're looking at damages, as you said, $5 billion. That's a tremendous amount. And, you know, we're not getting the donations from Red Cross. We're not getting them as much from Salvation Army as other natural disasters. So that is the question. You know, where is the money going to come from? So we're looking at maybe the state can help out out the area. I know just from Bay District Schools, they've asked for money to help with the mental health situation in schools. So these are other things that are aspects that you might not think about, because it's not the physical damage, but it's the emotional strain on teachers and just the community at large. So there's a bigger issue in that as well.
Emily Mahoney, let me ask you, where are the donations? Those traditional groups that that can raise tens of millions of dollars after natural disasters. So what do they say in response to the relative lack of donations in regards to Hurricane Michael?
Well, you're absolutely right that those donations really just aren't there. Of course, people have donated for Hurricane Michael recovery, but simply not in a way that's proportionate to the damage that was done. Obviously, Hurricane Michael was 2 miles per hour away from being a Category 5 storm. It produced more debris in Bay County alone than all of Irma in 50 counties in Florida. And so that gives you an idea of what we're talking about. But in terms of actual money collected, for example, the Salvation Army for Hurricane Michael has collected $2.8 million. After Irma, Harvey, and Maria last year, they collected a combined $125 million. So that's 45 times less for Hurricane Michael. And that's not proportionate to what kind of damage the storm actually did. And I think that a lot of that is in part because this was a rural area and not a lot of people, there wasn't as much sustained focus on it because there isn't a sustained national media presence in an area like the Panhandle. And I think that really affected kind of the amount of awareness across the country about just how severe the storm was.
That's such a good point. It's 305-995-1800 and tweets to Florida Roundup. Jessica, let me ask you about the growing calls to use money from the 2010 BP oil spill, the Deepwater Horizon disaster in the Gulf, using that settlement money to sort of bolster Hurricane Michael recovery efforts. There's been some noise about that. Some lawmakers say they will push for that in the March legislative session in Tallahassee. You know, we're talking about billions of dollars the state is expected to get over the next decade through the BP settlement. I would think in the Panhandle there'd be a lot of support for that idea. What are you hearing about that?
We are hearing a lot of support because people are saying we need help. And you're very right in saying that the national media, we really haven't been much of a focus. And I think it's because the Panhandle is not a large metropolitan area. A lot of the areas of the Panhandle that were hit by Hurricane Michael are lower socioeconomic areas. And some of that population, if we don't get help, they're going to cease to exist.
What are the implications of this BP oil settlement money? This money goes back, obviously, to the deep water horizon spill. It was destined or is destined to deal with, you know, the beach communities that had to deal with the oil slicks that spring and that summer, Emily. I mean, if this money is tapped into for hurricane relief, you know, some in Southwest Florida, for instance, have said that they may lose out.
Definitely. I mean, the state is looking at lots of different options when it comes to better funding recovery from this hurricane. And I know that that is a major thing that's been reported to be on the table. But as was previously stated, the population that was affected by this was low income. And because of that, many people didn't have insurance on their property. So that is just another kind of compounding factor that the state is taking under consideration and that lawmakers have spoken about in their early budget meetings as the session kind of gets underway. So that BP money, I believe it's up in the air, but we'll have to wait and see what happens.
And calls coming in from around the state here this Friday on the Florida Roundup as we look at the continued dire situation in the Florida Panhandle. 4 months after Hurricane Michael, the area is still struggling. Donations are not anywhere near where the region needs them to be. Should money from the BP oil spill settlement go to help the Panhandle? What are your thoughts? 305-995-1800. Craig is in Sarasota. Hey, Craig, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Good afternoon. It's very interesting that right before your program came on, there was a news story about the governor releasing his new budget for 2019. Mm-hmm. And so I'm sitting here thinking that perhaps some of that money allocated in other ways can be put toward relief efforts for the panhandle.
Thanks for that, Craig. Jessica Foster, there's certainly growing pressure on the state legislature to figure this out, whether or not they reallocate some of the $2 billion. But they are expected to consider spending millions of dollars of aid to Hurricane Michael recovery efforts. They haven't specified an amount, though, right?
We have not heard an amount yet, no.
Yeah, but $5 billion worth of damage, the need is vastly outpacing what the legislature can likely spend. But can you paint a picture for us what it's like there on the ground right now? How many families still without housing? How many families still, the last time you appeared on this program, we were talking about people living in tents months after the hurricane had gone through the area, that FEMA was on the ground, but that there were still so many people who weren't even able to access basic services. What's the situation like right now in terms of that?
More FEMA trailers are coming in, but it does seem to be a fairly slow process. And one of the issues that they're running into is an area to put the FEMA trailers. Also, what we're hearing a lot from homeowners now is that they didn't realize the extent of their damage. And so some homeowners that were previously living in their homes have later realized we have a mold problem and it's no longer safe for us to live here. That actually happened to one of my friends, and she had been living in her home. Then it was discovered that there were unsafe levels of mold in her home. So now she is completely out of her home and she is living in a travel trailer right now in her yard.
Jessica,
and these are stories we hear all the time.
Yeah, you talk about support and relief aid and recovery, and the FEMA trailer is just kind of coming in now to some degree, 4 months after the fact. We have a tweet here at Florida Roundup discussing the help that's coming in from the state and charities. What about money from FEMA and the federal government? This area is populated by people that support the current administration. Doesn't Washington care? That from Gordon via Twitter. What about the assistance from FEMA? And I know the governor was in the panhandle this week announcing that he has gotten the federal agency to extend the deadline for at least local governments to apply for FEMA reimbursement for the payments they've made to get rid of the debris.
Exactly. And they were realizing that the debris, it was such a massive amount that we needed assistance with that. And even if you drive around, you still see just a tremendous amount of debris. The governor has been on the ground a lot, and he is pledging to get those resources in. What we hear from residents is that they feel like there's just a lot of red tape with getting FEMA assistance. And that's what's creating this backlog and this long process.
Emily Mahoney, how would you compare the state's response to Michael as compared to other hurricanes where we've needed a massive state and federal response?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, I will say that I actually just joined here in the studio coming from the governor's budget announcement up here in Tallahassee. So I have those figures top of mind right now. And he announced that he is recommending that the legislature spend, I believe, about $270 million in state funding from the general revenue for all that would be all hurricane expenses, not just Michael. But of course, there are remaining expenses from Irma and previous storms. And in combination with federal funding, it would be about $2 billion total. So that's kind of what we're looking at here in terms of early estimates as far as how much the state is looking to spend. Every hurricane is different. Admittedly, I wasn't in the state of Florida for Hurricane Irma, but the governor, like Jessica said, has been on the ground and has been saying that this is going to be on the front burner for him. So it's nice that we can have a figure now as the conversation starts to get more specific.
Jessica, let me ask you about that kind of money and what the governor has talked about and his visits to the panhandle. You talked about kind of mental health needs within the school system. We've seen that after these kinds of natural disasters. But there's also county schools there that face a real cash crunch potentially because of a drop in enrollment, because people have simply moved out. They can't find housing. They don't have any housing. Perhaps their jobs have gone away, that they've moved out. And if they've taken public school children with them, the state money that comes with that headcount can be reduced. What's at risk there?
So one thing that our local school administrators have been talking about, the local school board, is that we may have to close schools. And what we have realized that the schools that they're looking to close are those schools that were in those low-income areas. So then that creates all kinds of other barriers, because then you've got to think about, what about the children that do still live in those areas? They're going to have to be transported to schools in other locations. So it really just creates a whole cycle of issues. And one school in particular, and that was in a minority community, and it had faced closure because of the school grades, because of failing school grades. They worked very, very hard to bring their school grade up to a C so that they could remain open. And now that is one of the schools that's on the chopping block.
Man, what's it been like? You've been at this now for what, 4.5 months, covering this pretty intensively in the panhandle, interviewing so many people that have been affected. What stories have stayed in your mind the most? What families that you've spoken with and their different situations?
What sticks out in my mind the most is, you talk to everybody, and it's not, you know, did you get any damage? It's like, how much damage did you get? And when I hear the people talking, they're like, but we're still blessed. We didn't get as much as so-and-so. So people are trying to stay positive, but they're weary. And they're worried about the long-term future, how long it's going to take to get things back to a semblance of normalcy. One of the big issues now, we talked about this when I spoke with you before, is that Panama City Beach was, for the most part, spared. Mm-hmm. It really did not have much damage at all. And so Panama City Beach is open for business, and we're coming up on our spring break season, the busy season. There aren't workers for some of the restaurants and stores.
So, Jessica, it's Tom. That's exactly what I wanted to ask you about, the tourist season, because so much of the panhandle is built upon the twin legs of agriculture and forestry and also tourism. And, you know, listen, the polar vortex is good for business in Florida, no doubt about it, right? I mean, even though it gets cold in the panhandle, certainly you're not talking about minus 30 and 40 and 50 degree weather like you're seeing in the upper Midwest. But we saw this after Hurricane Irma in the Keys, also dependent on tourism, where the workforce, the available workforce in the Florida Keys dropped by more than 10% in the year after Hurricane Irma. Companies and hotels and restaurants and dive shops and others just simply couldn't find people to fill the work. How big of a concern is that as you're moving into the heat of tourist season there?
Well, it's a very big concern. We have talked with business owners a lot this week, and they're saying, can you please get the word out that we are hiring? If people need work, we need them. Because a lot of the service industry workers, a lot of them were renters. They didn't have permanent homes here. And when the storm hit, they left. And also, when the businesses were closed for a period of time because they couldn't service customers, they were out of jobs, so they went other areas to look for that employment. So it is a very big concern. And at the same time, we're trying to get tourists here because we need that money to help sustain the county and the region as a whole.
Here's a tweet from another listener. The media would rather cover Puerto Rico because they can make it political. They are partially to blame. You know, Emily Mahoney, let me just say that we have made on this program, the statewide show, the Florida Roundup, a consistent effort to cover what's happening in the panhandle since the disaster. So for what that's worth, we are very much concerned with continuing to cover the situation in the panhandle. Your final thoughts before we go to break. Quickly, let's let people know how they can donate to help the region.
Yeah. So what has been interesting and quite frankly, very cool about reporting on the lack of donations is that since my report ran last week about the lack of donations to Hurricane Michael, the United Way of Northwest Florida is where people should direct their donations because they are supporting a local group called the Bay County Long-Term Disaster Recovery Organization. And since my report ran, they've received more than $13,000 in checks, and that will all go toward offering mental health services and helping people rebuild their homes.
That is great. That is great. Thank you for that. Emily Mahoney with the Tampa Bay Times, Miami Herald, Jessica Foster with WJHG in Panama City. Thank you both. Still to come, the governor says let's end Common Core testing standards in schools. That's still ahead on the Florida Roundup. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup. Thanks for being with us this Friday. I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville.
And I'm Tom Hudson in Miami. We are talking about Hurricane Michael, almost 4 months since the storm pushed ashore, pushed the Gulf of Mexico waters ashore in the panhandle, causing devastation throughout communities, billions and billions of dollars in damages, and the help, the assistance, the financial assistance, and the donations have been slow to come. Your thoughts on this, 305-995-1800. A lot of Floridians have a lot of experience with hurricanes and the aftermath of hurricanes. How does this compare to your experience? 305-995-1800. Emily Mahoney with the Tampa Bay Times Miami Herald is with us from our sister station at WFSU in Tallahassee. Emily, we were talking about your reporting regarding the lack of donations and how people can help in the outpouring that you've seen since then. The charities that you spoke with, how do they kind of explain the lack of donations? And have they been actively going after donations as they have in previous natural disasters in Florida?
Right. Well, I think that the charities probably have been making as many similar efforts as possible. Where we really see the change in behavior is by the donors. And that can be attributed to both individual households as well as large companies who typically subsidize much of hurricane recovery. I was actually in Houston following Hurricane Harvey and kind of witnessed the scale of the response when it came to charitable donations there. I mean, we're talking about hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars from big companies, from celebrities like J.J. Watt and Beyonce, who were raising tons of money because that was their hometown. And so obviously all of that money was needed in a place like Houston where so many people were affected. But in the panhandle, they just don't have that same type of celebrity presence or corporate presence that really kind of, I think, forces sustained pressure to donate. And because of that, and also I think because we had an election shortly after the hurricane hit and kind of directed national attention elsewhere, we saw a lot less donations from both individual households and from major corporations. For example, my story cites that the NFL gave $1 million to Hurricane Irma. They did not donate for Hurricane Michael. And that's just one example of many, I believe.
Huh. Whether it's Irma, Michael, going all the way back to Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans, that was a storm that forced mass relocations of people away from the Big Easy. And we're getting calls from listeners around the state wanting to comment on that. David is in Tampa right now. Hi, David. How are you today? Go ahead.
Good. Thank you. I had family living in Key West when Irma came through. And she was living in a rental, which many of the people that are in the workforce are living in rentals there in Key West. And the reason that one of the big reasons that 10% of the workforce left was that zoning saw an opportunity to rebuild the rental properties, but not in the form that they were. There was a lot of code violation. And so these homes became, or these rentals became uninhabitable, and the workforce had to leave. They had to leave to find places to live, not necessarily to find work.
Yeah. David, thanks for that. And that's a phenomenon we've seen, sadly, all too often. Jessica Foster with WJHG, what about that, where you sit in Panama City? Are people just throwing up their hands and leaving the area? No, I think we might have lost her. Emily Mahoney, have you been covering that at all? What do we know about people just leaving the panhandle permanently in the aftermath of Michael?
Sure. So I haven't had the opportunity to cover that myself, but one of my very close colleagues at the Tampa Bay Times, Zach Sampson, actually just released a story today about that exact issue. And he's been following a family who is dealing with that exact question in Mexico Beach. And I think that it's a question that is facing many people. And I think that it's without a doubt, we're going to see people leaving the area because it's simply not worth it to rebuild, especially as with rising tides and, you know, increased extreme weather events. Who knows when this could happen again? And so these small towns like Panama City, like Mexico Beach, that really relied on kind of a consistent small town community, you know, it's who's to say whether that community will stay together. And I think, you know, a lot of the longtime residents hope that that's the case.
Sure. Well, there's another story we wanted to make note of this week here on the Florida Roundup, one that's getting a lot of attention and a lot of discussion. This week, Governor Ron DeSantis turned his attention to education, announcing that he's ordering the state's education commissioner, Richard Corcoran, to come up with new education standards for Florida. Basically, what that means is we would get rid of what's left of the Common Core curriculum.
Today, we are doing an executive order that is going to instruct Commissioner Corcoran to get to work and come up with good standards for the state of Florida, which will include eliminating Common Core and the vestiges of Common Core.
This is a move that has drawn plaudits from DeSantis from both the left and the right, conservative-leaning education groups and the group representing Florida's teachers union have both applauded the move. Now, you don't often see that in Florida or really anywhere in the country. Florida's education standards are similar to Common Core, but not exactly the same. They were actually renamed the Florida Standards. So what does this mean for schools? How will the standards be used as something replaces Common Core? Have you had to help your student with Common Core standards homework? Are you a teacher listening to this? You know, I have a lot to say about the Common Core math. I can ask about this myself. But we want your calls at 305-995-1800. As Governor DeSantis says, Florida is erasing Common Core. As we continue now with Emily Mahoney at the Tampa Bay Times Miami Herald, with us from Tallahassee, and Jessica Bateman, education reporter with WLRN Public Media in Miami. 305-995-1800 as we change gears and talk about Common Core, or what will no longer be Common Core in Florida. Tweets to at Florida Roundup. Jessica Bateman, let's begin with you. DeSantis getting a lot of praise from both the left and the right for this. Both liberals and conservatives in Florida disliked Common Core, but for different reasons. Can you explain that?
Sure. So I think we should kind of take a step back and look at the background around the controversy over the Common Core standards. One of the main reasons why you see people on the right pushing back against the Common Core is because it's, first of all, it's a set of guidelines that determine what students learn in each grade. So it says in third grade, students in math have to learn how to do fractions. And in high school, students have to read a Shakespeare play, right? So it's like guidelines that then everything else that you use in a public school is based on. The curriculum is based on it, lesson plans, tests, textbooks, etc. So during the Obama administration, there was this competitive grant program known as Race to the Top. You probably remember hearing about that. And
sure.
This was at a time when, you know, the recession was happening. Pretty much all states were really trying to figure out how are we going to fund public schools because they were just having such a hard time financially. And so the Obama administration comes out with all this money. And one of the catches for applying for this money was that the states had to adopt what was called college and career ready standards. So standards that would raise the bar for academics and go deeper instead of more shallow. And then the idea was that it would prepare students more for college and for careers. So a lot of people on the right didn't like this because they saw it as federal overreach from the Obama administration. And Florida was one of the states that did adopt the Common Core as a part of the Race to the Top initiative. But amid that pushback from the right, as well as there was also a lot of pushback from parents and teachers. And this was for a few different reasons. One of them you sort of got at a little bit, which is that the way that Common Core teaches how to do math problems, for example, is different than how a lot of parents had learned how to do math problems when they were in school. And so now you have parents who are sitting down with their students and they're like, I don't know how to help you with your
homework.
That's
right.
And there was a lot of angst over that.
I plead guilty to that.
So many people I know and in my own house, we dealt with this.
A lot of people in your house, huh?
A lot of people who saw themselves as very smart realized, oh, maybe I'm not as smart as I thought. You know, and I remember a quote from Arne Duncan, Obama's former Secretary of Ed, Emily Mahoney, saying, you know, we're seeing this pushback to the race to the top standards and the Common Core standards because a lot of moms are realizing their child isn't the special, delicate genius that they thought he or she was, which was kind of a snarky thing to say. But it's really remarkable to see this happening in Florida. These were not beloved standards, although they were certainly well-intentioned to try to, you know, have a high bar for students to meet. So, Emily, you know, a question I have for you is, if Common Core is going away, what is it going to be replaced with? What will we see to take its place? Because certainly people that cover education in Florida can be pretty cynical about this constantly shifting landscape of how we're going to evaluate and measure student performance.
Well, yes, and I think that's the question of the day. And I think that, you know, you touched on how this move has brought so much praise from both the teachers' union and from Republican lawmakers. And I think that that is definitely true for now. But when this executive order came out, it's simply asking the Commissioner of Education, Richard Corcoran, to reevaluate the standards, to come back in a year and present the legislature in 2020 with his plan for Florida's new standards. And I think that when that happens, there will be fights over what different lawmakers, different parents want to see in those standards. But for now, because of kind of widespread disapproval of what people see as too much testing in the schools and standards that a lot of people aren't satisfied with, taking a look is definitely something that people support. But as far as the end result goes, I mean, that's anybody's guess.
And just to jump in and build on what Emily was saying, I totally agree that I think that the sort of kumbaya from everyone about this is short-lived. One of the other reasons why you saw pushback on the left from, or really on the left and the right about the Common Core was that at the time the Common Core standards were rolled out around the country, there were also a bunch of other education policies that came out at the same time, mainly teacher evaluations that were based on test scores. And so in a lot of states, they did this really quickly. They adopted the Common Core standards. They put out new tests that were based on the Common Core standards that were a lot harder. And so a lot of kids failed the first year, which is very expected. Even when you roll out a test based on the same standards, but in a different format, you see student performance dip. And then at the same time, you have teachers thinking, oh no, these new standards are harder. The students are going to fail the tests. And now that whether the student passes the test means whether I get to keep my job. And so I think a lot of people conflated all of these things together, and then it just sort of gave Common Core a bad rap. And then that continued, and we saw, you know, Rick Scott, obviously the former governor, push against this. And so he said, we need to look at Common Core. We need to get rid of it. And what they did was a pretty surface level revision. They essentially added a set of standards for calculus for high school. And they added a standard that said students have to learn cursive writing.
But perhaps,
and then they renamed it the Florida standard.
Say,
but it was still the same thing. Yeah.
Right. Perhaps most importantly for the opponents is it became Florida standards, not Common Core.
And this is not just Florida. Like many other states did
45
the same
states
thing.
Had Common Core standards originally as put forth by the Department of Education in 2009.
Right, and also many other states did the same thing where they did a pretty surface-level revision and then renamed it.
Let me remind folks that you are listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. 305-995-1800 is the phone number. Common Core in your house. How are you dealing with that homework? If you're a student, a teacher, how about a parent? You can join us on Twitter at Florida Roundup. Let's go to Casey in Hawthorne on line 8. Go ahead, Casey. You're on the radio.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just sat down. I'm a curriculum and instructional coach in Florida, and I was in the classroom as a teacher. And I actually just had this conversation with some other coaches and teachers that I work with about the switch. And we just talked about how Common Core has kind of become this dirty word for people, and parents, I don't think, really understand what it's about and like what it can really do for your kids, because I think that the basis of them are really good. Like, we're trying to prepare kids for when they enter the workforce, when they leave high school, or when they enter college. But it's become this kind of taboo word. Oh, don't say Common Core. And that's, I think, initially why they changed it from Common Core to the Florida State Standards. I think their real issue with Common Core isn't with the standards themselves. It's the curriculum that textbook companies are writing for the Florida Standards, because they're trying to cater to all of these different states that all have some sort of form of different standards. And so, and it's the way that the textbook companies are going about teaching the standards that I think parents are really thrown off by and end up not liking it, because they see, oh, well, this isn't how I learned math.
Yeah.
This is really confusing. But
yeah,
the whole basis behind Common Core is to provide students with multiple different ways to solve a problem, yeah, because every student is different and they learn differently.
Yeah, Casey, we appreciate the heads up there and some of that insight from the curriculum coach, Casey in Hawthorne. Yeah, lots of different ways to come to the answer in math. There's not always just one avenue to get to that right answer, as parents of grade school and middle school students have come to realize. But Jessica Bakeman, to Casey's point about the textbook and kind of the education industrial industry, another idea behind Common Core was to be able to kind of have states compare results, to be able to put Florida students up against Connecticut students and Arkansas students and Colorado students, and be able to kind of see and judge what's happening here.
Right. And I think that Casey's point also gets to probably the biggest challenge to actually make this happen. And that's what I was saying before about how the standards are this basis and everything else is based on it. So if you want to really, truly get rid of the Common Core standards and adopt something new, you're talking about getting all new curriculum, yeah, all new textbooks, all new tests. All of that is really expensive, which is what actually Miami-Dade County Schools Superintendent Alberto Carvalho said yesterday when he was responding to this. He was saying, listen, we need to do this carefully and methodically, because it's actually a lot more difficult than you think. And in fact, the SAT has been reworked so that it's based on the Common Core standards, because so many states adopted them. So I think that the question is whether this is going to be another surface level change that gets rebranded, that checks a box so that the governor can say, I followed through on my campaign promise, or whether this is actually going to be a massive overhaul, in which case it's going to require a lot of investment.
Right. And as you mentioned, it's expensive to replace books and materials. We're going to talk about that and who might stand to profit from these changes, and questions from you all across Florida about Common Core and the way we test and evaluate our students. Tweet us at Florida Roundup. Get on the line now at 305-995-1800. Common Core is going away in Florida, it looks like. Do you even know what Common Core is? We'll educate you on that, too, here on the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. Keep listening. Lots of calls. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to the Florida Roundup. Glad to have you along here in Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. As we continue taking your calls, tweets, and emails about Governor DeSantis' executive order to get rid of Common Core testing and education standards in Florida, it's 305-995-1800 as we continue with Emily Mahoney. She is with the Tampa Bay Times, Miami Herald, coming to us from WFSU in Tallahassee. Jessica Bakeman, education reporter with WLRN Public Media in Miami, also with us. Lots of tweets about this decision from the new governor. Nelson tweets the Florida Roundup. Whether parents think math is too hard under the Common Core standard shouldn't be the issue. He says preparing citizens for a difficult world where jobs that don't require high analytical capabilities is the real goal. I'm disappointed, he says, to see Common Core discarded. And let's go to a few more calls about this. What do you think? It's 305-995-1800. Anne Marie in Sarasota. Anne Marie, you're on the radio.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Sure, go ahead.
So I'm a parent. My son's in second grade, and so I can understand why people have a problem with Common Core, because it can be very confusing, and they don't really give you material as a parent to understand, like, hey, this is what we're going through this week, you know, so that way you can try and solve the problem with your child. But at the same time, I personally love math, so I like it in the way that it groups it into you have to group it numbers into tens, and so it's a way to kind of like visually see what you're doing, because people are visual learners. There's different kinds of people learn different ways, and I like the way that it will show you, okay, this is the problem, but you can solve it this way, solve it this way, or you can solve it this way.
And yeah, so different ways.
Right. So in that way, I can appreciate it. But at the same time, if you don't love math, like some people, you have a crazy life, you have to cook, you have to clean, you're doing all these things and sitting down and doing homework that you completely don't understand.
Yes, I know exactly what you're talking about, Emery.
So I can see parents are frustrated and just say, like, why are we adding
Exactly. And I so appreciate you sharing that. If you're a math person, this was a way to expand math education. If you're not a fan of math, you didn't like Common Core probably. And of course, Jessica Bateman, Ron DeSantis said he heard about this from parents on the campaign trail over and over and over again, and certainly acted on it. Let me ask you as a follow-up. We got an email about this from Andrew in Jacksonville. He wants to know, who stands to profit from this change? And how will all the new books and materials, how will they be paid for, given our current education funding? So what about that? If we make this switch, how will we build out the switch, and who will pay for all the changes?
That's a really good question. So we don't yet know exactly how they plan to go about coming up with a new set of standards. So that would be the first step, right? And I previously was a reporter in New York State, and I covered when they were coming up with standards, and they had this process where they had, teachers and other, principals and parents and all these people were like at the table helping to come up with these things. And I know that at the Florida Department of Education, they have a similar process for reviewing changes. So it's possible that the Department of Education might do this sort of in-house in terms of coming up with the new standards. But they also might bring in a contractor to do that. And once the new standards are in place, if that ever happens, then of course, school districts are going to have to be looking for, okay, now we need to find curriculum that is aligned to the new standards, or maybe the state has to commission a company to write curriculum that's based on the new standards. It might be something piecemeal. And then again, testing. The tests would have to be based on the new standards, and tests are really expensive to develop over time. You probably remember back in 2014, that was when Florida switched to new state tests that were based on the Common Core standards. And that year, there were like all of these problems. There were technical difficulties. Computers stopped working and shut down, and students lost all their tests and had to start again. And then there was a widespread questioning from superintendents, like, how are we supposed to trust that these tests are accurately showing what the students know? And that's really high stakes because of school grades and teacher evaluations. And the legislature actually sort of halted everything for a while and said, okay, we need to look at these tests. We need to make sure they're valid. Ultimately, they said, oh, they're valid. So these are the sort of things that could be ahead in the future as we start to go down this path.
Emily, is there really any question that they're not in the future? I mean, the governor's executive order says, quote, articulate how Florida will eliminate Common Core Florida standards and ensure we return to the basics of reading, writing, and arithmetic. That doesn't seem to leave much opening for the Education Commissioner Richard Corcoran to come back in a year and say, Governor, we looked at it. It's okay.
That's correct. And I think that, Richard Corcoran, the education commissioner, he was at this announcement with kind of standing alongside the governor and was, gave him much praise and talked about how on board with this he was. And so I think that there's no question that Corcoran will go along with this and take a really hard look at the standards. But the question really lies in what the legislature has to do, because ultimately this is all just a recommendation to the legislature. Mm-hmm. And I talked to Manny Diaz yesterday. He's a state senator from Hialeah, who is, you know, kind of a big player in the education sphere, has chaired many education committees over the years. And he said, you know, I'm happy that they're doing this. I'm happy that they're looking into it. And I look forward to reviewing their recommendations. You know, it's like,
right.
Even this is a Republican lawmaker who is clearly on board with the idea, but even he was cautious in saying that, you know, this is all just a recommendation to the legislature. And so I think that it's far from settled what this will look like and how much Common Core will be left in it, because of what Jessica was saying, that the more they change it, the more things will be radically different for the districts.
I also wonder, if you're a lawmaker, are you going to be able to look at the standards that Richard Corcoran comes back with and say, this is exactly how this is different than the Common Core? You know what I mean? The legislators are not necessarily curriculum experts.
That's right. And you're listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. As we continue taking your calls, tweets, and emails about Governor DeSantis' executive order saying it's time to do away with Common Core standards for Florida schools. You know, we were going to be talking this hour about Governor DeSantis allocating hundreds of millions of dollars toward Everglades restoration. But then this happened on Thursday, and we decided to shift gears. And judging by all the feedback we're getting from around the state, it's certainly something lots of people want to weigh in on. A few more tweets and emails. Here's one from Lori. I have a middle and a high schooler. I've been impressed with the Common Core math curriculum. It taught my kids to think flexibly in a way I wasn't taught. I had to read their textbooks so I could help them with their homework, much as my parents did to help me with new math. Remember new math? Here's another tweet. I hear all the comments about math and zero mention of reading comprehension and the integration of multiple subject matter for critical thinking. I find it incredibly shallow and uninformed for the governor to make a decision based on hearsay and hyperbole. And here's one more question that came to us from James. What I want to know is where funding is going to go. Public schools or private charter schools? Jessica Bakeman and Emily Mahoney, here's a related question for you. As we talk about the funding piece for education, do we stand to lose federal funding if we junk these standards? Can you lay that out for us as well?
I don't think so, Melissa. I don't think that that's because race to the top is over at this point. And there's not anything right now that's, well, so I guess the Every Student Succeeds Act does still have a requirement that states have college and career ready standards. That's the Every Student Succeeds Act is a federal law that was the rewrite of what was called No Child Left Behind. The Federal Education Department under Secretary Betsy DeVos has been kind of hands-off in a lot of these areas. So I don't really think that there's any concern that there could be some, you know, something comes down from the federal government saying, absolutely not, you can't do this.
And the governor said as much yesterday. He was asked that exact question when he made this announcement in Cape Coral, and he had the same answer, that he doesn't think that the current administration is on board with this either and that he has no concern.
It's important to mention, too, that along with getting rid of Common Core, DeSantis said he wants to move away from high-stakes testing in Florida. Certainly, he got an earful about that from parents and some teachers. And he even mentioned, let's get more civics education into our school system. Let me ask you about that quickly, Emily. The kids already, I think, have to take civics in middle school, but this would expand it even more. In the short time we have left, that seemed to be a big priority for the new administration. Getting away from the testing, the emphasis on testing, and beefing up civics.
That's right. And beefing up civics and teaching the Constitution was a major plank of the governor's campaign. It was one of his early education points that he started to make. And so, you know, it's unclear exactly what he means by expanded civics. He talked about making sure that textbooks are completely apolitical, and he wants students to really learn our history in like a straight down the middle kind of manner. So we'll have to see how that plays out. But it's definitely a big priority for him personally.
You know, one piece about this debate that has been interesting, we've talked about math, we mentioned the reading. There was a significant, Jessica, political dimension to Common Core. We saw that in the debate in 2013 and 2014 with Governor Rick Scott pushing against it. Where has that, is that spring still full? Is it still bubbling?
I don't think so. That's what's really interesting about this is that this controversy really kind of passed.
Kind of came and went.
Yeah. And, you know, I did a story about this during the campaign, actually kind of examining this particular campaign promise and looking at how difficult it would be to actually implement. And I talked to a couple of experts nationally who kind of follow what states are doing with curriculum and standards. And they said, yes, there are some states who are tweaking, making some small changes, but there's really no state that is like going completely in the opposite direction. But I guess now Florida.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Well, we'll see over the next year. Yeah, leave it to Florida. Jessica Bakeman covering education at WLRN Public Media in Miami. Emily Mahoney watching all things Capitol for the Tampa Bay Times and the Miami Herald Bureau with us from our sister station WFSU in Tallahassee. Ladies, thanks so much.
Thanks, Tom.
Melissa, I don't know about you, but on my homework agenda is fractions for the fourth grade coming up this weekend.
We're dealing with solving inequalities, Tom, which I could talk a lot about, but we're out of time.
Yes, we are.
That's our show. The Florida Roundup is produced by WJCT Public Media in Jacksonville, WLRN Public Media in Miami. Bridget O'Brien and Heather Schatz are producers.
Jason Zabka is our technical director. Theme music from Aaron Libos at AaronLibos.com. I'm Tom Hudson.
I'm Melissa Ross. We'll be back next week.